Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome once again to New Books in History, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Luca Heberle. Today, we'll talk to Dr. Nicholas Sharman about his new book, Britain's Informal Empire in Spain, 1830 to 1950, Free Trade, Protectionism, and Military Power, from Palgrave Macmillan. Nick, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to meet you, Luca.
Likewise. So, Nick, to start, I'd like to ask you to present yourself for the audience. Who is Nick Sharman?
I'm currently a research fellow at the University of Nottingham in the Midlands part of England. I've had a long career as an economist, as a planner, and as in management. But in the latter part of my career, I have turned to academic life, basically. That's who I am. And I got a master's degree 10 years ago at the University of London, and then a PhD at the University of Nottingham.
Great. And Nick, how did this project come about?
Yes, it was very interesting. My original research, my MA research, was into British economic investment and its relationship to the non-intervention policy that Britain pursued in the Spanish Civil War. And I knew that the conventional view was that Britain wanted to stay out of the Civil War for fear of destabilizing the European balance of power. That was the usual straightforward explanation. But that theory wasn't enough, in my mind, to explain why, less than 10 years later, in 1945, a radical socialist government, the Labour government of 1945, was prepared to keep Franco in power when the rest of the world wanted him gone, the only fascist, apart from Salazar, who survived the Second World War in Europe. And it seemed to me that there was a much deeper explanation than the politics of the 1930s. And the deeper I got into it, the more I realized how deeply entwined the Spanish politics, Spanish economy was with the British politics and economics. And so the project gradually unfolded as I dug deeper and deeper. And I found a turning point in the 1830s. That's when the absolutist monarch, Ferdinand VII, died. And a new era of what the liberal monarchy was launched with British support. And so it seemed to me that that turning point led to a deep involvement of Britain in the Spanish politics and economics. And that's the basis that I went into this project and tried to uncover both the events of the previous, of the subsequent century up to the 1950s, and the reasons for it. And that's what drove the project, if you like.
Mm-hmm. A certain longue durée perspective, if you want.
Absolutely. And I think that's very important, Luca, that I think too much of historiography has concentrated on quite short phases and that has helped, has tended to mean that the emphasis has not, or insufficient emphasis has been placed on longer term factors. So part of what I was trying to do with this book was precisely, as you say, to look at the long durée and to try and find those forces that operated over the whole period.
Right. And what would you say is the main contribution of your book to academia and public discourse?
Two things that really stood out for me. First of all, the extent to which Spain's development, politically and economically, particularly from the 19th century, I mean, one can look more deeply at the entangled empires of Spain and Britain in the 18th century, but the real change came in the 19th century when Britain became deeply involved in Spain's economy and politics. And my what I think I've shown through this book is how influential Britain was in shaping Spain's development, and particularly how Spain was shaped by the interests of Britain's new industrial and trade empire of the 19th century. And it also showed how that relationship changed with the growth of the British Empire in the 19th century, reaching its climax, if you like, in the late 19th century, and then its decline during the 20th century. So we could actually see this book also as the story of the British Empire seen through Spanish eyes. And the second issue that I believe it does is to show how Britain's interest in trade and its deep involvement in investment, especially in minerals, drove that relationship. And this is the second half of the book, showing what the reaction in Spain itself was to that pressure, how Spain's politics, how the discourse, the economic discussion and issues that were raised were around free trade and the resistance by the protectionists. So there was not only a deep involvement of Britain, there was a resistance movement, if you like, in Spain, in the protectionists. And what I want to do is to bring out the importance of that protectionist, not as simply stop it, we want the world to go round. They came up with an alternative, positive strategy, an alternative to free trade. And I think historians have not taken that dimension of what I call the liberal protectionists have given it sufficient emphasis. So those are the two contributions: Britain's deep involvement in Spain for over a century, and the resistance by elements of Spanish society.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we dig deeper into your research, I'd like to ask you a question about the archival work you did. What would you like to highlight about this work?
Yeah, I mean, it was pursued in both Britain and Spain, the archives of both Britain and Spain. The key one for me, I suppose, was the archives in Kew in London of the Public Records Office, an extraordinary treasure trove, extremely well organised, in which you can track through the discussions between ambassadors and the government in meticulous detail. So that was one very important source, not least in the 1830s, when Britain had a particularly strong influence in Spain. But it runs all the way through to the cabinet discussions in the Labour government that I talked about earlier in 1945, a fascinating picture of how cabinet government was running. So that was one key one. The other very important source for me was the extraordinarily good archive of newspapers in Spain. I think it's one of the best collections of Spanish newspapers, really well indexed with a very good background. And the press in Spain in the 19th century was extraordinarily varied. Quite a narrow readership, quite a narrow set of class interests. But within that, extraordinarily varied, with papers popping up, publishing for a few years, highlighting issues. So you could get a sense of certainly what some of the key actors were talking about and discussing. So those were the main ones. And then I also, in the Spanish archives, looked at Juan Güell, for example, has got a very good archive in Barcelona, a key source and interest of mine was how the Catalonians reacted to the British imperial power, and particularly the British attempt to destroy their industry. So Barcelona was a very good one. And then there are a number of Spanish government archives in the Alcalá de Henares, the big government documents there. But I put that in that order of importance.
Mm-hmm. Now we can begin to discuss everything in more detail. So the main theoretical pillar in your work is the concept of informal imperialism. That's why I'd like to ask you a couple of questions about it. First, what do we mean when we talk about informal imperialism? Then why do you find this heuristic insightful? And why is this idea especially useful to understand Britain's relationship with economically weaker countries?
Yes, I mean, it is absolutely important, key issue in the book. And I devote the introduction to defining informal imperialism, to looking at how the concept has gone through a number of phases. Very famously, a pair of British academics, Gallagher and Robinson, in 1953, wrote an article in which they interpreted Britain's development of its empire, not in the conventional idea of painting the world red, i.e. sending, dominating and taking over countries, as in Australia, occupying and pushing people out. So that what they said was that, in a sense, was the second level of the British Empire and not the primary draw. What they argued was that Britain's need, as its Industrial Revolution launched in the early 19th century, it found that it didn't have sufficient domestic markets, particularly for its cotton goods. And later its engineering production was so dynamic, it was so way ahead of the rest of the world, that it could do two things. One is it needed new markets. The British market was pretty tied up by the 1820s. And if you date the Industrial Revolution, the launch of the factory and the machine in a serious way from the 1780s, by 40 years of that, Britain's market was exhausted. So what Gallagher and Robinson argued was that Britain then needed to find markets for its new industries. And it used the idea of free trade to open up markets in other countries, which were then very protected ones in Europe in particular. And actually in the Americas as well, all those were protected markets. What it wanted to do was to open those up, and what its bargain was: look, we can offer you markets for your products. We can supply in exchange for you opening your markets. We're not insisting on you buying our goods. We're simply saying, let's have no as free trade as possible, as few tariffs barriers as possible, because they knew that their production costs were so much ahead of everybody else that they could dominate it. So what informal imperialism is an economic idea in which you go into a country, you try and reduce its tariffs, you then bargain with the elites to ensure that your markets, their markets are open to you, and then you can dominate the economy and these countries without actually the expense of running them or the difficult politics that's involved in running them. And that idea of informal imperialism as the way of explaining the development of the British Empire was very powerful and got a lot of support. It then fell out of favor because it's quite hard to define when, for example, do you move from simply an imbalance of trading power between countries to imperialism, which implies a much deeper form of domination. And Gallagher and Robinson were rather vague on that point. And so many historians said, look, this isn't a precise enough definition to allow us to use it as a framework. And they tried to show that this doesn't explain everything in the development of the British Empire. So there was a lot of controversy. And I think what's brought it back into play is a recognition that you can't do without it. How do you explain how Britain, and most particularly how America in the post-war period, has managed to dominate the economy using free trade as a model? And that, I think, the reproduction of informal imperialism under America has said, well, wait a minute, there is even if it's difficult sometimes to define everything, there's a core truth here about how countries actually operate and how they develop. So what the argument comes is, when you get a dominant hegemonic power, as you got in the 19th century in Britain, its ability to dominate the world trading routes and its financial dominance, when you get that and a very efficient modernizing economy, you are able to dominate and buy off the elites and dominate countries. And that, I think, can be argued just as true, or, as I said, of America in the post-war, post-Second World War phase, when it was the dominant hegemonic power. So I think informal imperialism has reappeared as an important historical idea. Why it's I think my innovation is to say, if that worked, as Gallagher and Robinson argued for countries in particularly in Africa and South America, and the Argentine example is the one that is most often quoted. Why would you not see particularly the problematic economies, the less developed economies in Europe, also falling within it, within the power of Britain's informal empire? And I suppose that's really the core of what I'm proposing in this, that Spain's economic weakness and its strategic weakness, its military weakness, relative to Britain, opened it out to domination. And the reason, and this is very important, the reason I argue that it amounted to informal imperialism rather than just, if you like, economic overwhelming economic power, is because Britain ensured over a long period that Spain's both its economic policy and its political attitudes reflected British interests. And crucially, at key points when Spain looked as if it might move out of the British influence, Britain intervened militarily. And that, to me, is what I use as the key differentiation, if you like, between simply having more economic power and having a situation of informal imperialism. And the reason for it was this strategic driver, because Spain was geographically right at the hinge of Britain's imperial trade routes to India, to Africa, to South America. And particularly when the Suez Canal opened up, it became absolutely crucial. And Britain was desperate to ensure that none of the empires to the east in particular found an alliance to Spain, which would then enable those powers, Germany, Austria-Hungary and Russia, to have some sort of strategic naval base that would might threaten Britain's crucial trade routes. And Gibraltar was the key base for that. One British admiral in the late 19th century said there are five keys that lock up the globe. And Gibraltar was one of them. The others included Dover, the Channel, key trade route into Northern Europe, Singapore, the China, and obviously Suez. So Gibraltar was a core defence requirement for the full period that I'm considering, 1830, right up to 1945 in the Second World War. So it was those two issues, trade, economic exploitation, and the strategic position of Spain in Britain's imperial network.
Mm-hmm. Well, then in chapter two, you describe the role of British envoys to Spain as kingmakers during the First Carlist War. Could you give us an overview of this conflagration? And what role did the British state and British capital play in it?
The Carlist War, the First Carlist War, was the absolutely key hinge point for British intervention. When Ferdinand died, the British very quickly moved in to support the liberal monarchy. And it had two motives. One, the one I've just given, the strategic need to ensure Spain didn't become allied with the Holy Alliance of Prussia, Austria-Hungary and Russia. And the economic, the need to find new markets for the dynamic cotton industry. So, and they were very clear from the beginning that that's what they wanted the monarchy to do. When the monarchy, when Don Carlos, threatened the new monarch on the argument that he should have been chosen, and it shouldn't have gone to down the female line, Don Carlos was very committed to building this alliance with Prussia, Russia, and Austria-Hungary. And so Britain saw Don Carlos not simply as disturbing their relationship with the new liberal monarchy, which they wanted to survive. They saw him as an existential threat, and they therefore allied with particularly with France, to ensure that the support for the liberal monarchy, and they although France contributed to it, there was no question that it was a British initiative in the 1830s. They wanted a trade-friendly regime. And when that was threatened, they put in massive support. They put arms, munitions. They blockaded the whole of the north part of the Bay of Biscay to make sure the Carlist armies couldn't be supplied. They used their growing power in the city of London to try and prevent any loans being raised. And they put in a 10,000 strong army into to support the liberal monarchy. So this was a major military intervention. And it reminds one, I think, of similar initiatives that the Americans have put in over the years, not least in parts of Central America and in Southeast Asia. You can see this is the way to prop up a regime that they see as critical and they see as having an important economic. So what we see in the 1830s is Lord Palmerston, who's the Foreign Secretary, very quickly, the week, the month before Ferdinand died, gets his very close friend George Villiers as what they called minister, not ambassador, but minister into Spain. And one can see, and this is where the archives are fascinating, the letters that go backwards and forwards from Villiers to Palmerston through the 1830s absolutely show that the British were kingmakers. They were very close to the monarchy. They advised on the composition of cabinets. They were key influencers on who the prime ministers were. They advised on military tactics. And of course, the reason they could do that was that they had they were supplying the arms which and the resources that kept the armies alive. So that is what they did. And as I say, you can see how closely the relationship between the monarchy and the government, various governments during the 1830s, was. And of course, the peace of the peace at the end of the war was supervised by the British in drawing the war to a close. So that whole period of 1833 to 1839, the period of the Carlist War, was one in which Britain played a leading role. And I think that's not really understood, let alone the motives which drove it.
Right. And then in the third chapter of the book's first part, you examine a nowadays mostly forgotten conflict, the war between Spain and the Moroccan Sultanate. Yet this war is far from being an irrelevant historical episode. Indeed, you argue that at this moment we can already recognize the formation of an embryonic national Spanish identity in the shadow of Britain's ever-vigilant empire. How did the war begin, and why did the Spanish government at the time decide to pursue it? On the other hand, how did Britain manage the risk this conflict posed to its trade routes?
Very interesting. And you're absolutely right. The Africa War has, I think, been neglected as a key turning point. It didn't have any enormous long-term impact on, for example, who was running Morocco. But what it showed was two things. By the late 1850s, Spain had Spain's economy was beginning to modernize. So Spain was more confident. It intervened in wars in South America, as you well know, in the 1850s. But its major interest was in south of Spain, over in Morocco. It saw an opportunity there with its new wealth, growing wealth, and army, who had been a threat to domestic politics. There had been a number of pronunciamientos during the 1840s, and there was a worry that the army the army could be best used not to undermine Spanish Spanish stability, but to pursue Spain's imperial dreams in Africa. This was a time when other imperial powers were beginning, the French in Algeria initially, and then along the North African coast, Britain's exploration of Africa. There was a beginning of a right at the end of the 1850s, a sense that Africa was opened up and Spain wanted their share of that. They therefore manufactured essentially a war to give Spain an excuse to march in. And they did so with great popular support. The idea that Spain was now had recovered from the humiliation of the Napoleonic Wars and the subsequent economic decline, that it was now on the up and could regain its position as a great European power. And why? So they manufactured a dispute with the Sultan in Morocco, and launched an expedition to, as they said, punish the tribesmen who'd attacked one of their forts in Maia and Ceuta. So they launched this expedition, which actually showed how weak the army was, but it eventually did manage to conquer the key town. And based on that, they then said, well, why don't we move on to Tangiers and dominate and acquire territory? And it was at that point that Britain said, we don't mind you, quote, punishing the tribesmen. But as soon as Spain looked like it might stay, they stepped up, they stopped the army in its tracks. Literally, they said, do not go any further. And the army had to stop and retreat. And the reason was that the whole army was being supplied across the Gibraltar Straits, and Britain dominated that. So Britain could literally turn off the tap that supplied the army Spanish army was forced to retreat to its bases and then out of the country. So, but during that process, a very interesting happened, and that's what I wanted to point to, the birth of a national opinion in Spain. Because by the 1850s, you had the railways beginning to network across the country, you had the telegraph, you had newspapers being distributed around the country. So you could see the beginning of an infrastructure in which the very dispersed geography and politics of Spain was beginning to create a national feeling. And when you combine that with the dreams of imperialism, and there was a really massive support for this intervention. And I think it's one of the few times when you could look to Spain and say there was a genuine enthusiasm for war across the classes. Most wars in Spain have been deeply unpopular amongst one part of the population or another. But this one genuinely brought people together in support. And the humiliation when Britain literally just pulled the rug under their feet was intense. And there was a very strong anti-British feeling that spread throughout the country. And you can see, I think, why it's important is you can see this during the rest of the century leading to Spanish dreams of intervention in Morocco. And that's there's a whole story there in which I deal with in the post-1898 disaster when Spain and the colonization of Morocco by France. That the Moroccan dream, if you like, was launched in 1859. And the idea of a Spanish public who participated in and supported that was also born at that point. So it has no immediate impact on diplomacy, but it had long-term impact on how Spain coped with the rest of the world.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Something that I found very interesting was British policy leading up to and during the First World War. Because if I'm not mistaken, in the years leading up to 1914, as well as during the war, British policy regarding Spain was mainly concerned with the protection of strategic supply chains. Mm-hmm. And the magnitude of British actions to this end was quite significant, even hard to grasp. What was the strategic significance of Spain and its trade with Britain? And moreover, which means did the British state use to secure these crucial supply chains?
Very, very important. And again, I think that's one of the things this book really tries to bring out, which is how important in the latter part of the 19th century, how important Spanish minerals were to the British economy, but actually to the European economy. It was before the supply of copper, iron, sulfur developed throughout the world, not least in America. Both North and South became key suppliers, and Africa later on, and Australia. But all those developments really were only beginning in the late 19th century. And Spain was accessible. It had this extraordinary sources of mineral wealth, particularly down in the south, in the province of Huelva, and in the Basque country with the great iron ore supplies, iron ore that was particularly appropriate to the way that steel was produced. So those minerals were absolutely key in the second phase of the Industrial Revolution. The first phase was powered by coal and steam and iron. The second phase turned to chemicals, electricals, in which sulfur and copper became crucial elements. And Spain was the source for Europe of those minerals. And Britain made sure that it used its power to dominate the supply chains of that minerals. It itself had run out of its initial iron ore and was desperate and bought up many of the rights to the iron ore mines in the Basque Country and dominated the production of copper and sulfur through owning the biggest companies, two of the biggest companies, which were world leaders in production. And the British economy became very tied to that. And particularly at times of war, these minerals that I'm talking about were crucial to munitions. And so in the First World War and the Second World War, those minerals, the supply of those minerals, was absolutely central to Britain. And there was a real worry at one point in 1917 that Britain would not be able to acquire sufficient of those minerals to keep the Western Front going. And there was a whole idea of building, particularly after the submarine war destroyed a lot of the Spanish fleet, and the Britain couldn't use them. They were actually going to try and do it by rail. It was so important to them. So I'm just really emphasizing how key that was. And the way Britain guaranteed that was to blockade the peninsulas, the Iberian Peninsula, on a number of occasions, but the First World War and the Second World War was very important. The First World War was extraordinary. Not only did Britain blockade it, it then also controlled the coal supply to the rest of Spain and used that to actually acquire a lot of industry that other foreign industries. So they pushed out a lot of the allies, the Germans and the Dutch industry and acquired it themselves, and even the French. So economic competition was going on even as they fought the war, because everyone wanted to be in a good position after the war. So you can see how economic interests, Spain as a prize in this, was absolutely central to a whole dimension of the war, which again, I think we over-concentrate on the Western Front and don't think about some of the things that drove it. And it made Spain a very important actor in the First World War, although, of course, it was neutral formally.
That's great. I think that we can now move to the more to the side of your work that's more related to intellectual and political history. Mm-hmm. Because, well, could you tell us a little bit about Edoald Jaume Andreu, Juan Güell y Ferrer, and the nature of the relationship? Moreover, could you explain their political project of protectionist liberalism? Because I fear this could sound like an oxymoron to many of our listeners.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think this is one of the second main argument that I'm trying to introduce into the book. The first is around the idea of the informal empire and its long-lasting life through the century, over a century. The second argument, as I've said earlier, is how that impacted on Spanish politics. And I interpret the Spanish protectionism that emerged in Catalonia, but was later joined by the Basque Country, the industrialists in the Basque Country. I interpret that as not simply as traditional historians have often characterized it, as a self-interested protection of their particular markets. They're just going to impose inefficient industry to make sure that they can keep up their profits, and by implication keeping Spain in economic second place. That's the traditional argument, and why I think you're absolutely right. Many people would see it as oxymoronic or even a contradiction in terms to talk about protectionism and economic development. And it's important to see how deeply that idea was embedded in Spain. The Madrid elite and the commercial interests, the international commercial interests in Cadiz, for example, and Barcelona were part of this. They, for them, free trade meant commerce. It meant they were banking it, raising the cash for it. So they saw anything that threatened trade with the rest of the world as a threat, and that they were so strong, those feelings, that by 1869 the revolution of the school, La Gloriosa, we saw an adoption by the regime of a total free trade model. But that meant that the interests of industry were destroyed. And I've got a great quote from the British in the 1840s, when they were trying to ensure that free trade allowed British cotton goods in. It's the British ambassador who was negotiating with the Spanish government said, "It is assumed that the admission of British cottons at moderate duties will entirely destroy the manufactures of Catalonia. To compensate for this branch of national industry, it will be necessary to make large concessions in favour of agricultural interests, particularly for Catalan wines." And what you see here is it's a quote that absolutely illustrates how Britain wanted to see dependent countries like Spain It knew that it needed to, if it wanted to sell goods into Spain, it had to have a way of those goods being paid for. And where they, Britain saw countries like Spain, but equally countries in South America, was as food suppliers, and they wanted to make prevent any rivals, industrial rivals, springing up. So the British economic policy was absolutely clear. It wanted to destroy industrial rivals and compensate for Britain's enormous population expansion, which it couldn't feed itself by drawing food in from the rest of the world. Now, the reaction in Spain was the Catalan industrialists came up with an alternative model of economic development. They were not simply about defending regional interests in the area. They said, we want to see the whole of Spain develop an industrial economy. We want to put industry at the forefront of economic development. And given that our industry is relatively undeveloped, we will need a period of protection in order to allow it to develop. Moreover, we will need the government to help support this. Small companies operating by themselves will not be sufficient to overwhelm the overwhelming power of the modern economy in Britain. And so that basic idea of defending your infant industry actually emerged very early in Spain in the early part of the century, with and was best expressed by Udal Jamandreu, who was an Augustine priest and economist, who argued on behalf of the Barcelona manufacturers for a model which said, keep your industrial competitors at bay while you develop the industry. And this was not a permanent thing. What they saw, it was a necessary step towards being a competitive model. And I think that's the key issue here. All the protectionists that I go through in the 19th century, the liberal protectionists, all saw protectionism as a temporary stage in economic development. And real protectionism would be simply to pretend that the world didn't exist, the rest of the world didn't exist, and that they could guarantee a closed economy. That was far from what they wanted. These were a faction of the elite that wanted to see a different economic model. And I think the key thing to emphasize is that that was the route that the United States and Germany used to develop their industry. And indeed, Britain itself was one of the most protected economies in the 18th century when the Industrial Revolution developed. So the idea of protecting your industry, building its strength, and then launching yourself into the world market had some very good examples. So this wasn't, as I say, some reactionary, inward-looking force. These were people who were really plugged into the world, acutely aware of the weakness of the Spanish industrial economy relative to the rest of the world, and determined to try and argue for the state protecting them and also supporting them.
Mm-hmm. And now I think that this question is important. So how does the protectionist liberalism that flourished in the 19th century and persisted well into the 20th one differ from the nationalistic autarkic tradition embraced by the Franco regime?
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating story of how the liberal protectionism that I've just been talking about, launched in the early 19th century by Hamandayo, and then taken up notably by a man called Juan Guel, became a key industrialist in the mid-19th century, and who for 30 years argued the case that I've just been discussing. Indeed, there were liberal protectionists right up to the beginning of the 20th century. And I go into some of those people, Santiago Alba, for example, and before him, Pablo de Arzola, the great Basque politician. So there were this strand of liberal protectionism was influential, but it never won the support of governments through the 19th century until the great agricultural crisis of the 1870s, when that industrial argument, how do we develop industry, was joined by the great wheat growers, particularly in Andalusia and Castile, who were very concerned about preserving their markets both domestically and notably in Cuba, from the opening up of the very competitive wheat supply that was emerging from the United States and then slightly later on from Russia, as the new steamships and trains could bring this massive amounts of wheat onto the world market. And so they... particularly the Castile wheat growers were key in tipping the ideological balance at the end of the 19th century from free trade into protectionism. And during the 1880s and 1890s, led by Canovas, the great prime minister of seven times prime minister of Spain, the conservative, adopted protectionism on national grounds, arguing very strongly that the country was being undermined by the export of all its precious products in the minerals and that it needed this protection. But the policy that emerged was not the liberal protectionist model. It was a very conservative model that was about preserving the social structure, particularly in the landowning market, the landowners' interests. And so by the time we see the 20th century, protectionism is becoming a conservative, not a dynamic force. There were attempts under Primo de Rivera, for example, to try and his finance minister, who I deal with at some length, Calvo Sotelo, to try and revive that model by investing in the infrastructure in Spain, of in trying to get some government intervention in industry, something that Guel had argued for in the 1850s, only appeared in a rather moderate form in the 1920s. So by then, it was really hard work, particularly when the slump came in the late 1920s, and that swept this away. So Franco, by the time Franco takes over from 1936 and then finally 1939, there is a emergence of a very conservative view of trade and investment. And that is a fully autarkic model that argues that you can create a self-contained, self-sufficient economy based on military power rather than international competitiveness. And you get this during the 1940s in particular, but deep into the 1950s, you find that this autarkic model it ends up by failing, but it comes out of that conservative move of the or taken to extremes, that conservative turn of protectionism in the late 19th century.
Right. Well, before we end, Could you explain or name some of the key economic transformations that did happen after the autarkic turn?
Yeah, I mean, basically, Franco's policy, and I deal at length in the book with how that was formed by Schwanthes, the architect of his policy, who has had an immensely powerful role from the late 1930s right the way through until the mid-50s, when he ran the intervention, economic intervention and economic policy, basically. And what became clear during the early 1950s were two things. First of all, the policy was not leading to industrial development. Spain was stuck and couldn't even feed its own population in the 1940s. And the other thing that was happening was that America was assuming its hegemonic role in both strategy, the Cold War, if you like, and its domination of the financial system. And America pushed Franco, with the support increasingly of the new technocrats who were coming up in Spain in the 1950s, towards a neoliberal model, opening it out to opening the country out to the world. World markets, both in investment and trade. And that's by the end of the 1950s, we have the stabilization plan, which closely followed by the final expulsion of Schwanthes from Spanish government. So that crucial few years at the end of the 50s, you see a fundamental change. And through the 1960s, the opening up to tourism, the gradual opening of the economy, which doesn't really take off until the death of Franco and the accession to Europe the European Common Market, as it was, or the European Community in the 1980s. But that key moment in 1959 begins to chart a whole new direction for Spanish policy.
Now, before we leave, I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me, Nick. I'd like to ask you what projects loom in your future.
Yeah, I'm been drawn into this world of the 19th century, I suppose. And what really interests me is how liberal politics developed in Spain. Because, as I've tried to explain, I think the liberal protectionists were an important force in Spain. And more to the point, how liberal politics emerged as a reaction in a wider sense, to the invasion of modernity that Britain represented. So what I'm looking at are the influence of Britain's economic ideas, people in the early 19th century, Adam Smith's successors like David Ricardo, Jeremy Bentham. They were all very involved with the exiliados, the people who had been pushed out during the wars, the Napoleonic Wars, and ended up in London and absorbed a lot of these economic and political ideas, but giving it a very Spanish feel. So the whole constitution, the Cadiz constitution, to me is a fascinating way in which political and economic modernity happened. And then all the way through the century, you get invasion of British employers in Rio Tinto Zinc, for example, who then impose the law of the market. And Spain's liberal politics is partly accepting, partly rejecting it. So my project is to trace it through. But what makes it really interesting to me is working with colleagues in Nottingham to relate those economic and political trends to the way that literary and philosophical thinking developed in Spain. So it's trying to, if you like, have a dimension of looking at philosophy and literary development in Spain through this the new eyes of the materialistic culture, the liberal ideas that were spreading, and some of the conflicts within it. So it's a big project. I hope we can bring it off. But it's essentially a multidisciplinary one, which I'm very committed to. Long durée, working across boundaries. That, to me, is the future of history.
That sounds great, Nick. For the listeners, we discussed today with him Britain's informal empire in Spain, 1830 to 1950, free trade, protectionism, and military power, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Thank you, Nick, for your time.